The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier and Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, hello, and welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show EDU edition for this week. Brand new topic today for the EDU show. We're going to do a bit of a dialogue show, which for longtime listeners, you'll know what that means. If that doesn't mean much to you, what we refer to as a dialogue show is when we take generally email feedback or questions that have come in from listeners that are particularly geared toward our process, our philosophy, our approach to retirement planning, which we talk about a lot on the show. And we love to hear from people who, especially do-it-yourselfers out there, who are using some parts of, to different degrees, our approach to retirement planning. And sometimes they'll provide us with, kind of their twist on things, how they might be doing things a little differently than we do it, or have questions of clarification about our approach. Those types of things. That's what we refer to as dialogue, because it's kind of a back and forth about, it's not just us delivering information. It's kind of a group effort, if you will, between our approach and description and feedback from you all out there in listener land. So today, Jim's got a couple different things. We've got a few emails that have actually come in, I think because we've mentioned it recently, about unicorn status. What the heck we even mean by what we describe as a unicorn, and maybe if someone should strive to be a unicorn if they're not naturally such an animal. So we'll talk a bit about that. And then also, we've talked recently, which is kind of a hot topic with the current market volatility, proper asset positioning in retirement. And we've had some requests about, positioning in the transition period, what most people refer to as kind of the few years leading up to retirement, even though you're not quite in the retired category yet. Jim and Jacob have their own name or description for that period of time. I think classically in our profession, it's been referred to as the transition period, but from the accumulation phase to the distribution phase, that's the transition being made. And so we'll talk a little bit about that as well. So with that kind of introduction, I'll bring in both Jim and Jacob. Jacob was so excited to be on the show just a few days ago that he demanded to be on the next show as well, and we were happy to welcome him with open arms. So you'll hear from Jacob as well as Jim and I. So if the two of them are ready, they can chime in and give me a break from talking, because now that I look at the timer, I'm at 4 minutes or so, longer than I expected to take on the intro, but phew.
You talked for 4 minutes, or is that including the recording that you play before?
Probably three and a half minutes of me, it appears.
Wow, yeah, that is a little bit verbiose. Yep. You need to take a book out of my play. You need to take a play. Christ. You need to take a page out of my playbook. I knew I would get this.
There we go. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And be more pithy and direct and to the point.
Yeah, I'll try. I'll work towards that.
And master the English language better, will you?
Yeah, I try my hardest, but it doesn't come naturally to me.
I know. Although I did kind of giggle to myself how Jacob demanded to be on the show again.
Well, that's how I understand it. Was that not how it worked, Jacob?
He did. He waltzed into my office, and slammed his fist down on my desk and demanded to be better represented.
Yeah, well, after, you know, I came into Jim's office and I said, hey, you know, after the first topic of my introduction about me getting scammed, if you've listened to the last podcast episode, I decided, you know, I had to get back on immediately and get off to a better foot with maybe some more fun discussion rather than, you know, such a stressful discussion.
You know, it makes me think someone did send us an email for you, Jacob. Oh, gosh, why didn't I think of this ahead of time? Let me see if I can get it. Something about, because you mentioned you had a debit card, right?
Yeah, yep.
Let me pull up his email to you. Okay, PSA for you. So he said, I love, 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 love your show. I learn something new every week. I'm currently retired and listen while I walk and or run. He gives a hint. We'll skip his little hint. He just wanted you to know, many banks will allow you to lock your debit card in their app, particularly for ones you don't use much or only use for ATM withdrawals, and this will be a good idea for you. He does it, and he unlocks his debit card only when using the app, and then he immediately locks it again.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's a great tip. And actually, I think Joe in the office had mentioned that to me either later last week or earlier this week as well, as something that I think she's pretty good at practicing that. So that is definitely something that I'll be enacting going forward.
Yeah, that's a good thing to think of because usually most people, including myself, think of that lock feature in the bank app as, oh my gosh, I left my card at the restaurant, so I'm going to lock it so nothing happens until I can retrieve it or something like that. They leave it unlocked by default and then only lock it in an event. But I could see the logic in leaving it locked by default and only unlocking it for use, unless, of course, you've got it set up as the payment method for any kind of automatic, you know, subscriptions or something like that. So you'd probably need to rethink that. But talk about, one would think that would be a very secure way of treating your debit card is keep it locked by default, you know, and then only unlock it for transactions. That's an interesting way to do it. I hadn't really thought of before.
Well, I'll share what he wrote, Jacob, in his next paragraph for you. I had someone attempt an online transaction on one of my debit cards while it was locked. I received a text notification from the bank of the attempted transaction. I have my account set up to text me for every transaction on the debit card. By time I called the bank to alert them it wasn't my transaction, they had already reversed it because the debit card was locked. Mm. And another person reached out, and I apologize to that person, for Jacob as well. I can't find the email. And he didn't recommend a lock. He recommended something else that he wanted me to tell you. Because he's mentioned that even though you got your transaction reversed, it probably wasn't immediate. And I do remember him writing something to that effect. And then, Chris, this gentleman shared that he received, it was reversed right away because it was locked. And then they canceled my debit card immediately and sent me a new one with a new number. So I don't have a debit card personally, but you two both have it. I like this gentleman's idea as well. Certainly not the direction I wanted to go with on today's show, but somehow it came up, so I thought I would share that with everybody. Yeah. The other thing, since we're talking about this, I'm going to put a shout out there. Somebody sent me a question. Goodness, probably 2 weeks ago now. I can't find it. For the life of me, I have no idea what I did with it. I do know my Outlook app on my computer updated automatically to some new version, which I despise. And somehow I deleted, can't find, no matter what I do. But I remember the hint. If you sent an email and your state hint was, I live in the only state that grows coffee, and the answer was Hawaii, if that was your hint, I kind of liked your question. I can't remember what the hell it was, but I tried to move it into my question folder and it disappeared. I don't know how. And when I search Chris for the word coffee or Hawaii, it doesn't pop up in the deleted folder, in the question, nowhere. No, nowhere is this email. But I swear I wasn't dreaming or smoking anything wacky. I know there was an email from someone whose state hint was, I live in the state that is the only state that grows coffee. If that was you, please send me that email again. Thank you very much. Okay, let's get to the purpose of this EDU show. This is going to be a two-part EDU show. Not necessarily for the first question. The first question may go a little bit longer than 20 to 30 minutes. It depends how deep Chris and I want to get on it. But for the second question, even if we didn't have the first question, I would probably take two shows to address the second question, mostly in light of what's going on with the equity markets. And a very good point the listener made was, hey, I'm kind of in the middle between sandwich, like the sandwich generation, sandwich between accumulating assets and distributing assets. I'm kind of freaking out a little. What should I be doing? So I thought that was a great question, and I wanted to give it its due. So this will probably be a two-part EDU. Let's get to the one that really revolves not so much about investing, but more of what a unicorn is, which is a direct phrase from our approach to retirement planning. And it simply means both of your expenses, if you will. Your minimum dignity floor of food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare, those major five major categories of expenses that can have dozens upon dozens upon dozens of individual expenses under them. Everybody on this podcast will concede that. Chris, myself, Jake, Jacob, if he was here. No, Jacob is here. Jake, if he was here. Keeley, Greg. We would all agree there can be dozens and dozens of expenses under each of those broad categories. But those are expenses, folks, that will continue for as long as you live, whether you have money or not. That is the key. The key here, whether you have money or not. No one has ever proven to myself or to Chris in the decade plus that Chris has been doing this and 2 decade plus period of time. Gosh, I'm screwing up royally today. 2 decade plus period of time that I've been doing this. No one has proven to either of us that a human, at least in today's modern society, does not need to cover their food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare needs. So if you thought about things or look at it, that represents probably 60 to 70% of your spending needs in retirement, probably closer to 80 to 90% of your spending needs in the what we call slow go and no go phase of retirement. But nonetheless, that's the first group of expenses. The second group of expenses to us are what we call your fun, because after you take care of minimum dignity floor expenses and make a reserve for how you want to approach aging, and we're not going to get into aging and LTC expenses necessarily in this question, but once you take care of your minimum dignity floor and your aging and reserve needs, the remaining dollars of your expenses in every year of retirement is for fun. That's why we call it the fun number. Now, that's not to downplay aging, LTC, and emergency expenses. It's just that they don't occur every day unless you unfortunately suffered a serious long-term care need, and that changes everything. And we're not talking about that. But those reserves for emergencies, LTC, and aging just kind of sit there until needed. And hopefully, you'll never need them and you'll die without accessing them. Or if you do need them, hopefully it's well after you had your go-go phase, your slow-go phase, and you're now in your no-go phase of retirement. So with that in mind, you truly have two major annual ongoing expenses, minimum dignity floor, and fun. A unicorn can cover both those expenses, hopefully for the rest of their life, to be a true unicorn, can cover both those expenses with what we call secure income, your lifetime stream of guaranteed income. You technically don't have to debit any of your assets. So that's what a unicorn is. And it ties into literally an email that I received as I was driving home from the office today. I'm recording this from home, but I was in the office earlier and I told Jacob he's coming on the show. I told Chris that Jacob will be on the show, and we're going to do one question on a unicorn that we received, and then investment questions. And as luck would have it, this isn't the question that led to the EDU, but I want to just knock this off my list. This literally came in today as we record this on April 8th. It says, "Hi, Jim. I'm a regular listener to your podcasts. Always find them valuable and entertaining. I hail from the state that was the first to ratify the 13th Amendment." Now, I don't have ChatGPT open to play, and Chris, you don't have to answer. Jacob, do you have any idea what state was the first to ratify the 13th Amendment?
No clue. Something on the East Coast.
You got a 1 out of 50 chance. Just try it.
New Hampshire.
Illinois, but you were close. Okay. Here's a simple question. I hear you and Chris occasionally use the term unicorn, but can you please explain and describe how and what this label is? Appreciate your overall perspective on retirement and the detailed expertise. What surprised me, Chris, was he said he's a regular listener. Do we not mention unicorn often enough, you think? Or it's just, I don't know.
Doesn't come up super often, but we do mention it periodically. Sometimes when we mention it, we don't give the detailed description of what it is, like you just did moments ago. So for newer listeners or those who might have missed a past show where we dug deep into unicorn status, I could totally understand why they might have missed it, even if they're a listener.
Okay, fair enough. But let's get to the actual email that caused me to say, hey, let's dedicate a little bit of an EDU show to this. And this begins, "Dear Jim and Chris, you have talked about the concept of a retiree having unicorn status, as defined as having enough income for both their minimum dignity floor and fun number. Years ago, in a previous podcast, you mentioned that there may be a portfolio level or a distribution percentage that may allow someone to forego purchasing a guaranteed stream of income due to the level of their net worth. For example, say somebody has 80% of their minimum dignity floor covered by Social Security and pensions, and the remaining 20% of their minimum dignity floor and all of their fund number represents about a 2% distribution from a conservative-based portfolio. Does that person, in your opinion, qualify as a unicorn? If not, would you suggest that that person still purchase a guaranteed stream of income so they can obtain unicorn status? Or is an extremely low distribution rate to cover a small percentage of your minimum dignity floor and fund number a close equivalent to 100% covered by guaranteed income? In other words, would you approach retirement planning differently based on someone's portfolio value that has a high multiple of expenses or a very, very low distribution rate?" First thing I want to say before I throw a lot of this over to Chris is Unicorn stat, you can call yourself whatever you want. It's not that in order to be a unicorn, you truly have to have what we are espousing. Our definition of unicorn would be that your minimum dignity floor and your fun is covered with secure income. So I'm going to give the definition of what I consider to be secure income. Chris can chime in a little bit on what this gentleman is asking. We also, Chris and I, often will look at streams of income that don't meet the definition I'm about to share with you of secure income, and we'll consider it long before we tell that person you need to go out and buy an annuity. And we don't mandate someone goes out and buy an annuity. We just make that recommendation. But one of the sources of income that will not meet secure income definition is rental income from real estate. But we will often include that long before we tell someone. And Chris will explain in a minute why we do include real estate. But there can be a catch to real estate. It depends what would happen if the income stream of real estate, which is the actual rental of the property, whether it's a home or a business, a commercial or a residential, what would happen if the renter all of a sudden is gone? That plays a key role in how we would view that. Same thing with the portfolio situation that this listener is asking about. So let me give my definition, listeners, of what secure income is. And then, Chris, and then Jacob, I'm going to have you talk about, without mentioning the client's name or the investment, the research we did recently for somebody who is being proposed a portfolio. I think you're going to be able to share some interesting facts about their existing portfolio that we uncovered that kind of tie into what this gentleman is talking about. So I'll have you two go in that direction. But before Jacob and Chris take over, folks, I explained what a unicorn is and how minimum dignity floor and fun spending factor into that definition. But what's secure income? Secure income is kind of a concept that I developed, not because I'm overly brilliant, it's just made common sense to me. That in my simple approach, for something to truly be considered secure income, so you don't have to worry about it. Remember, to me, retirement planning is a seesaw ride or a negotiation, if you will, between the younger you and the older you. And I don't care if you're listening to this at age 50 or at age 80, there is always going to be an older you. That's you tomorrow. You're older tomorrow than you are today. Retirement planning is taking a limited supply of wealth and trying to equitably and fairly divide it between two you who are diametrically opposed to each other. Younger you wants to spend the money now. Older you, he kind of wants you, or she kind of wants you to reserve that money for them later if they need it, especially if they need it while they're aging and they can no longer physically take care of themselves or mentally have the capacity to manage it. They want it simple and easy and guaranteed. So they, or an agent under a POA, or a trustee under a revocable trust, or even irrevocable trust, can step in and assist them. So it puts you in this bind that we all will experience, myself included. How much do I spend when I'm retired right away, when I have the health, inclination, desire, and ability to spend on fun? And how much do I have to reserve? And it also addresses another fact in life that as I age, even me, even Chris, and yes, Junior, who's I think only 27, and he, to him, 50, 60, 70 is like 100 years from now. At 27, we just don't think that way. But trust me, Jacob, it's coming. And the knowledge that our ability to understand financial concepts will diminish. In 20 years, Jacob will know more about retirement planning and investments than I will. Why? Because in 20 years, I'm going to be pushing 80. And Jacob isn't even going to have reached, according to Harvard, the pinnacle of where his brain understands financial concepts, which is age 53. We're in two different phases. Everybody listening to this is in a different phase. So I thought when I came up with this concept, if I know my clients are going to age, if I know, even if they fully understand things today, the older them may not. And if I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare expenses must be unquestionably covered for the rest of the older me's life, no matter how long older me may live, I need to do it with what I consider to be secure income. And to me, that's three elements. First, the amount of income is predetermined and known. There's no ambiguity. In my 50s and 60s, I will be able to easily quantify. And years ago, when I was only in my 40s and 50s helping people retire, I still needed to be able to quantify as a 45-year-old advisor what my 65-year-old client might be receiving at 85. There could be no ambiguity in my math. So the amount of income that's going to be paid has to be predetermined and known, number one. Number two, if secure income moves at all, it can only move higher. What good is it as if it could drop for the 85-year-old you? That does the 85-year-old you no good. Might have made perfect sense at 60 when you were figuring this out, but, God, things didn't work out, and the 85-year-old you is getting less. I couldn't have that. So if secure income moved at all, it was like a ratchet. I'm sure all of you know a ratchet set. I still to this day have the very first ratchet set I ever bought, a Craftsman. Those things lasted forever. And I was still just using it the other day, changing a tire on my wheelbarrow with a ratchet set that I literally bought in Massachusetts. That's how old this thing is. But it still works. But that ratchet would only move in one direction. When I was tightening, it would only move to the right. When I was loosening, it would only move to the left. It moves in just one direction, similar to secure income. If your payments move at all, they can only go up. But the third element, and this ties into what this gentleman is asking, the third element truly to me is just as important as the other two. Secure income is not backed by your assets. In my definition, doesn't mean you can't do what this gentleman's asking. But technically speaking, in my definition, secure income is not backed by your assets. Might have been funded by your assets, but it is backed instead by a deep-pocketed third party. In other words, the U.S. government through Social Security, a pension, and also a pension that is backed by the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, PBGH. I have to slow down on that to make sure I get that acronym right.
C.
Or PBGC. Initialism. Did I get it wrong?
Yeah.
Ah, damn it. What'd I say?
You said PBGH. It's PBGC.
I was testing you. Very good. Jacob, you didn't pick up on that. See how Chris did?
I was thinking it on my side here. I just, figured I'd be respectful and let Chris speak up.
Well, listeners, I was testing both Jacob and Chris. Very good, guys. Put stars on your forehead. Okay. So, deep-pocketed third party. It's essentially risk pooling. That's what I'm describing in that third part of the definition. If everything is coming from your assets that you're trying to manage, that you are supporting, with caveats, as Chris will mention in this gentleman's email. But at its core, my fear was the money ran out. Ran out because maybe you overspent it. But how about if it ran out because you were a victim of financial fraud? We just did two shows on this. It's going to get harder and harder and harder to protect yourself from financial fraud thanks to AI. That I can guarantee you. It is freaky what's happening out there. Chris and I's voice could easily be cloned today, right now. And a podcast played of me saying how wonderful the New York Yankees are, and I've always loved the Yankees, and the Boston Red Sox stink. And it would sound real, even though anybody who knows me knows my thought is the other way. Try being 85 and getting a phone call from your great-grandchild or your grandchild in their voice pleading with you to send money because they're in Tijuana and they're in jail and they need help. And it's them live answering questions you are asking. That's coming. How easy could it be in the future to be victim of a fraud and lose that money? So that's why I always said, I didn't know AI 20 years ago when I came up with this was even going to come. Nobody even knew what the heck that was. But my fear always was, what if the money ran out? When it's just you, you're unilateral. What I used to give, the analogy I gave folks, was a zebra on the Serengeti. In the rainy season, when the grass is green and blowing and beautiful, and you're that lone zebra, and you're looking out, and you're thinking, life is wonderful, look at all this food, weather is beautiful, it's not too humid yet, grass is green, plenty of water, oh, I'm so happy, wagging your little zebra tail, running around. Life is great. Until you come across that pride of hungry lions. Now life ain't going to be too great anymore. It's great until it's not. And you come across a pride of hungry lions, and you're the only zebra. If you've got the only portfolio supporting your secure income, and all of a sudden things that we can't even fathom starts happening in your 80s, it could really screw things up. How do zebras get around that? Risk pooling. If you're a lone zebra on the Serengeti, you're a pretty dumb zebra on the Serengeti. And according to Darwin, you deserve to go because they got to get your genes out of the pool. Survival of the fittest or survival of the brightest. A smart zebra just gets in a big herd of thousands of other zebras. That's risk pooling. And a zebra is still going to go down because that pride of lions is hungry. But all those other zebras are supporting the community. That's risk pooling, and that's what I meant by secure income is backed by deep-pocketed third parties. Your pension is backed by all the employees, the employer managing it, the custodian and trustee they hired to manage the pension and actually buy the investments, and if everything fell through, by the U.S. government itself with the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. So security is backed by the U.S. government, which we're told is the most secure investment around. And the annuity is backed by the claims paying ability of the issuing insurance company. One of the reasons I tend to not like private equity owned insurance companies for lifetime guaranteed income. I might be okay with them for a MIGA, a FIA. I don't use FIAs, but if I did, I might be okay with them for that for a couple of years. Lifetime guaranteed secure income, me personally, I won't touch it. But a mutual company, been around for 150 years, 200 years, highly rated, I'd be okay with that because they're pooling it with thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of other people. That's secure income. Let's get to his question then. Would we consider him a unicorn if his withdrawal is just 2% or less? Jacob and Chris, you guys take over and wrap this bad boy up.
So I'll say first, technically he doesn't meet our definition of unicorn. He could apply his own definition, but he's not meeting our definition due to his own admission that his MDF and funds expenses are not, in fact, covered by his existing secure income. But the essence of the rest of his question is, should someone strive to become a unicorn if they're not naturally? And we don't generally promote that because the unique part about unicorn status, which goes above and beyond what we recommend as an approach to the level of secure income you should have, is that their secure income is covering fund expenses. And if it doesn't naturally do that, it's one thing, certainly, if you're in a beneficial enough situation that you find yourself to be a unicorn. That's a lovely place to be financially. But reaching for that, not something we would generally promote. Is there something wrong with it, though? No. I would not try to talk someone out of buying additional secure income to become a unicorn if that's what really creates the sense of comfort, well-being, freedom to spend, those types of things that lead to a promising and fruitful retirement. So I wouldn't discourage someone from doing it, but I wouldn't necessarily promote someone that wasn't naturally going that direction. Now, in his case, even though he's not a unicorn, he's in a, sounds like a very beneficial financial situation that to cover the rest of his expected expenses that his secure income doesn't, only needs a couple of percent from his existing, in his own words, conservative portfolio. If it's that level of distribution from this, and of course this is, we're trusting that he's done the projections to realize that these numbers are accurate, or as accurate as they can be, you know, with reasonable assumptions. So just taking it at face value, if that's truly the situation, I would leave it up to, you know, the person individually, whether they should buy more secure income. While, you know, he not only is not a unicorn, he admits he doesn't even have his MDF, his minimum dignity floor, covered, which is part of what we recommend to most people. But in a case where the asset values, because let's step back just a little bit and talk a little more about why we recommend the secure income to cover the MDF, is it's our approach to longevity protection. In other words, trying to remove as effectively as possible the chance that you will run out of money and not be able to cover the basics of food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare. The secure income approach is really designed for that longevity risk. So another way to have longevity risk protection is just have so much money that it's really not reasonably expected for you to run out. And if your distribution levels are truly 2% or below, the chance, while not zero, the chance should be very, very low that you would run out. So if someone said, you know, I'm hesitant to buy more secure income because my expected distributions to cover my remaining MDF and my fund are so small compared to the level of assets, I wouldn't say, oh, no, our approach dictates that you get enough secure income to cover the minimum dignity floor. It's rational, I think, and common sense to admit, you know what, the chance of not being able to cover the minimum dignity floor, very, very small in your case. So we really don't need to worry about the longevity protection some additional secure income might add. So the good news is for him is I don't think, unless he's trying to become a unicorn, you know, put on the clothes, you know, he's a horse now with a little bump on his head. He's in a really good position. He's not quite a fully formed unicorn. If he wants to, you know, put that appendage on and become a unicorn, he certainly could do that. Sounds like he's got enough assets where he could easily generate more secure income, truly secure income, in order to become said unicorn. But I wouldn't necessarily promote that. And I don't think that's, I think that's his question, is would we try to encourage him to be a unicorn? My short answer is no, after that long explanation. But that's kind of where I wanted to share my observations immediately. And then, Jacob, you can share a little bit about things from your perspective.
Well, I just kind of wanted to, share maybe a little bit of a case. I think, that Jim and I have kind of been working on for an existing client over the last couple of weeks that, kind of falls into not one for one, right? But a similar kind of boat where, we've been working with the client for a long time. Obviously, I won't say their name, and they have historically had, a conservative risk tolerance where, similar to what it sounds like this listener is saying, hey, my portfolio can remain kind of allocated in a conservative type of allocation and, still pay out that, 2% or less kind of distribution that we've been talking about to meet his specific needs. This specific kind of client that I'm talking about in this example here, long story short, a broker had kind of reached out to them to, propose a potential allocation for her to actually switch into. She had reached out to Jim and I to kind of look and compare her current portfolio that she's kind of held with us at her request over over the last kind of decade or so to what this broker was kind of proposing that she might switch into here. And the long of the short of the story is, as Jim and I kind of went back, we looked at the couple of mutual funds that this woman has. Again, I'm not going to say the exact name of the mutual funds, but they are, conservative, traditional fixed income style of mutual funds. The long and the short of this is, when we went back, we kind of looked at how much those funds had kind of provided in income and yield to her, because those were the two kind of priorities for her, right? Being conservative, she wanted to use these funds for income. That was the initial reason why she asked us to purchase them for her. These funds, I mean, they're old, legacy mutual funds. On average, they had looked to have paid, around 5% or so in kind of yield on an annual basis over the last at least kind of decade or so for this specific person. So the reason that I, wanted to kind of bring up this example is just to kind of say that, hey, although this gentleman, this listener, is not meeting our unicorn definition by the typical kind of standard of covering things with secure income, if he is a, has can afford to have a conservative portfolio, absolutely there are options on the investment side where this person could, allocate their portfolio into something similar to what I described, maybe a more conservative fixed income style of allocation. And, the history would show you that for the most part, right? And there's no guarantees, right? That's the downside of this being an investment rather than something like an annuity. But history would kind of show you that you should be able to find some allocations that consistently would pay, enough yield to kind of match the 2% or less figure that this listener is kind of saying that he would maybe have to withdraw to meet that remaining shortages. So again, just kind of an example, right, that stumbled into our lap that we kind of looked at over in the last couple of weeks there, but something to just kind of consider as far as, meeting that kind of air quote unicorn status while not technically meeting it by purchasing secure income. There are investment options out there that would match maybe a conservative risk tolerance that this person might have that would meet that kind of 2% or less yield, at least typically, to cover that shortage that he might have.
Yeah, I want to share a little bit more on that. And I don't think we're going to get to the second question. We'll dedicate two EDU shows to that second question, the next two, because I thought of a couple of things that I want to run with on this show. Chris, if possible, can you get the annuity quote thing that you use, the service or whatever? Because I have some thoughts that I want to share. But back to what Jacob said, and then I'll have Chris work with me on another way to think of what this gentleman is saying. The portfolio that Jacob did the analysis on, that I assisted him for this person, she had institutional share classes. So these were lower share classes of mutual funds. We generally don't use funds in our practice. We use ETFs, but the key was the retail version of this fund, long before the institutional share class came out, stretches almost 20 years. So this fund has a long storied backing, and it consistently has distributed around 5%. Now, I can't say it's going to do it forever. That's what makes this different. It could drop. But with a 2% withdrawal need and a fund that consistently pays out, that's good. And would we consider that? Would we try to talk someone out of it and say, oh, no, you got to put your money in an annuity? No, absolutely not. Now, if it was the other way around, if the fund consistently for nearly 20 years paid 2% and the client needed 5%, and they were going to try to make up the other three by withdrawing from this reserve and hope that they live long enough. No, we wouldn't consider that by any stretch secure. But if someone is going to do what this gentleman recommends, I would try, oh, not recommends, was asking about, I would try my hardest to make this as close to true secure income, in the sense, get everything to be automatic, get the distributions from the fund that's distributing out this 2% in this listener's description, get it to be coming out automatically from the fund and into your bank account, similar to what an annuity would do. Give very explicit instructions to whoever's going to be stepping in for you if you were to become incapacitated or just age out of being able to handle investments anymore, what this particular investment is, what it's geared for, what these expenses are, the income rather is intended to cover. Be explicit on this. So the distributions are automatically going into a bank. There's clearly disclosed information. If it's in a brokerage account and you did have it in a revocable living trust, have the trust be explicit for the trustee that, hey, if you step in to help me, this part of my portfolio, this particular investment, and I would try to find one fund. The broker who was trying to convince the person that Jacob was talking about said, oh, you don't want to use just one fund. Now, we disagreed with that. This was one very storied fund from multiple managers. We weren't carrying a management risk. Almost 20 plus years history. So broadly diversified. Now, the broker was trying to get sell commission-based products that were going to make the woman have to pay a $5,200 commission, which she was very surprised when we pointed that out to her. The broker had never mentioned that. My point is, it's very easy as you get older to maybe be swayed to do something different. Hey, this is working for both. This sounds really good, this little shiny toy over here. I would try to put some protections. If you are going to reserve assets and you want 2% from these assets are going to generate the income you need, put some protections around that. Protections that would have come with a traditional single premium immediate annuity where the money is now at the insurance company. There's no broker who's going to try to swipe that from you, or advisor, not just a broker, nothing against brokers. This just happened to have been a broker, but no one is going to try to convince the older you, hey, this shiny little toy is better over here. But also somebody stepping in who now has to manage your assets needs some very clear guidance and direction of what these assets are doing. Whereas if it was an annuity, I'm not saying you shouldn't have clear instructions for someone, but it's a lot easier to say, hey, George, if you step in, this annuity payment from XYZ Insurance Company goes into my bank and it helps cover my food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare expenses, along with my Social Security and pension payments that also go into that bank account. That's pretty easy. You need to leave that kind of guidance as well. That would be my only caveat to that. All right, two things I want to cover, Chris. I do want you to wrap up the show and later about real estate, because that's usually where we run across this. Uh-huh. We run across people who have one or two rentals.
Yep.
And how we, in some situations, have no problem considering it secure income, literally, because if the income stopped, we're fine. And you know where I'm going with this. But there's other ones where we would be a little hesitant. Uh-huh. But before you get to that, we don't have anything because this listener didn't give it. But I think you'll see where I'm going, Jacob and Chris, on this. Let's just assume, because he said 2% withdrawal. Let's just assume he needs $40,000 a year of additional income. At a 2% withdrawal, what is his reserve going to need to be? Somebody got a calculator. I don't have a calculator here.
$2 million.
2 million? Okay. So this person could put 2 million aside and take 2% a year from it. But Chris, let's just say they're 75. This person's from Texas, that I'll tell you, and he's a he. Did not share if he was married. Let's just make him single and a he in Texas. Mm-hmm. How much money would a 75-year-old in the state of Texas need to pay an insurance company? Let's do it two ways, completely level and increasing at 3% a year. Two quotes for an annuity. What would he have to put aside?
400,000 if it's flat. And then you said with a
3% annual COLA.
3% annual COLA. 500 to get a 3%.
Okay. So follow my logic here. He could put $2 million into an investment that's going to pay him the 2%. Mm-hmm. Now, Jacob just explained to you, he helped somebody analyze a fund that she owns. And again, it has consistently paid 5. But you only need 2. Now, that's good because as inflation attacks this spending, there's a lot of built-in inflation protection here because if the fund can continue to pay 5, this person can keep increasing withdrawals. Single premium immediate annuities work a little differently. There are none. The last one was in 2020 from Principal before it closed, that you could get a single premium immediate annuity that would actually increase your payment every year by CPI. Those don't exist anymore. So I just wanted you guys conceptually to understand two ways of looking at this. If the Fed is successful long term, maybe not in any given year, but long term at trying to keep inflation at their 2% target, Chris and I like to use a 3% COLA. Because if you look at inflation historically, not in any given year, but over the long term, it's been 3% or less. There's been periods where it's been more. There's been periods where it's been significantly less. So we're just choosing 3. So this man could put $2 million aside, start his 2% withdrawal, and have a fairly good inflation adjustment. But he's got $2 million in a portfolio that you will admit, Jacob, the one you analyzed, did a wonderful job at distributing 5% because that was its aim. Its aim was not growth. But you'll also admit, Jacob, in the analysis, the NAV of the fund pretty much stayed level. There were some periods where it was up a little, down a little. The fund's doing what the fund's supposed to do. It was trying to distribute income while protecting Principal, not necessarily growing it. Correct, Jacob? That's what you said.
Exactly. Exactly. Yep.
Okay. What I had Chris do was say, hey, how can an annuity do what's going to take this man $2 million to do? Chris, what's mortality credits?
Well, that's when the payout on the annuity is adjusted to reflect the fact that some people in the pool, so those are all of the annuity policy holders in the pool that are grouped together for the risk pooling, that the payouts are adjusted upwards to reflect the fact some people will die prior to median life expectancy, leaving money on the table, I guess you could call it, which could go to people who live longer than median life expectancy. And that additional payout is referred to in the insurance world as mortality credits.
So that's why an insurance company would want from a 75-year-old male in the state of Texas, your sex male, your home state, Texas, come into this calculation. So you can't rely on this. And this is live as of 4-8 of 25. It'll definitely be different by time you listen to this tomorrow on 4-9.
And single.
And single, right. If you want a joint and survivor payout.
It's 500.
For Joint and Survivor?
For Joint and Survivor, 275-year-olds.
Mm-hmm. For 275-year-olds. Staying level at 2%?
Staying level at 40,000?
Yeah.
With the 3% COLA attached to it, the 500 for a single becomes 640 for a married couple.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But let's stick to the single, folks. We've thrown a lot of numbers out there. Conceptually, I want you, don't concentrate on the numbers. We're just trying to show you this works. I'm just trying to talk to you conceptually. What if this person said, hey, I could put, as a single male, $500,000 into a single premium immediate annuity. I've got the money. I could live off of 2%. I could buy this mutual fund that has near 20-year track record of paying around 5% a year. This gives me a buildup for cost of living increases. And my portfolio probably won't grow that much, but it's probably not going to run out, and I will consider it secure income. I have no problem with that, listeners, at all. But what I'm saying is, what if he took $500,000, bought a single premium immediate annuity that would start him at $40,000 a year, but increase that $40,000 every year as long as he lives, whether he lives one more year or 30 more years, and increase it at 3%. Allowing him to take $1.5 million and invest the hell out of it. And don't concentrate on right now, there's the tariff tantrum and the market is going down. Long term, all of you VGs know, markets come back. And this one will as well. Trust me. I don't know if it's going to come back next week, next month, next year. Most bear markets last no more than 18 months before recovery begins. I don't know where that's going to fall in the historical average of recovery. But I know at some point in time, Chris and I will be doing this podcast and the market, and here I'm talking S&P 500, will be reaching a new all-time high. It's going to happen. What if he could take now $1.5 million? When I say invest the hell out of it, he can be aggressive with it. He's got everything covered, guaranteed. Think of the potential phenomenal growth he could get to leave an inheritance to a human or to a charity. This gentleman is a physician. I know that based on his signature line. I don't know if he's like me, no wife, no children. Hopefully he has a wife and children. I have bad luck in that category, but maybe he doesn't. But what if he did, even for me? There's some charitable causes that mean a lot to me. I don't talk about them on the podcast, but there are some. Maybe I would want to grow my wealth to leave to charity. I'm also toying with the idea of leaving money to a donor advised fund for the benefit of Jim Salyer and Associates for gifting in the future when I'm dead and gone, to promising college students for scholarships in financial planning. I never shared that with you, Chris, but that's something I have an attorney right now working on with me. What if I want to kind of grow the amount of money that I might be able to leave to that donor advised fund? Why would I reserve $2 million to live off of 2% withdrawal with a built-in COLA? Being the 5% payout I can get from this mutual fund, why don't I put 1.5 invested aggressively for growth, have my income needs covered? I favor the 3% COLA for another $100,000. $500,000 growing at 3%. What if inflation goes through the roof, Chris? Is my $1.5 million growing gone? Does the charity get it right away?
No, it's still there as a reserve to either embellish that SPIA, that secure income that you're talking about, or buy more SPIA if the desire hits you.
Or take an occasional withdrawal right in a high inflationary period. Mm-hmm. I'm getting a 3% average COLA. What if inflation starts getting to 7, 8, 9 and stays up there for a couple of years? I'm not going to sweat it. I got $1.5 million reserve growing to who knows what. I can take some money out. Jacob, you will be, hopefully, if you quit, you're dead, so you can't quit. So you're my advisor. And you say, hey, Jim, I see what you're doing here. But let's put some of that money that you might need as inflation adjustment in a, what type of investment is running through your thought process right now, Jacob?
Maybe something like one of those buffer products that you guys are talking about on here, right? Where you've got at least a little bit of a degree, right, of principal protection, as we always say, Jim, but still not, you know, limiting yourself to saying, hey, I'm going to put this in a money market or a CD that's, you know, specifically kind of locking in maybe a lower single digit rate of return or interest rate, maybe a buffered product where, again, if markets do go up, you're participating in at least a good chunk of upside based on where caps are at right now. But if inflation comes up and, right, the timing is bad, maybe you've got a little bit of that downside protection in there to be able to tap in and sell some of those funds to supplement that SPIA for high inflation years.
Excellent. You're handling this well, Jacob. Now you're seeing what Chris goes through when I just throw these things out there. Jacob is thinking exactly, and it's good. I did a lot of training. Jacob is wonderful, and so is Chris. Both Chris and Jacob are phenomenal. But Jacob is correct. Perhaps I put some of that $1.5 million in 100% buffered product. Why? Completely liquid. Are we going to address this next week? So we won't go down that rabbit hole, Chris, Jacob.
Yeah.
But yes, maybe I have some money in that, but it still has the potential to grow 6, 7, 8, 9% or more or less, depends what cap rates are. But the vast majority of my money is fully invested, much more aggressively than I might in an income generating product. Anyways, neither approach is right or wrong. I'm just trying to give this listener and all listeners food for thought. A lot can be said for the safety, security, stability of a lifetime stream of guaranteed income, and the annuity is going to give you something no other product would give: mortality credits. And Chris, if it's going to be way too impossible to do before you get to real estate and wrap the rest of the show up, is it possible for you on that $500,000 quote, $500,000, $40,000 a year to start, growing at 3%, single man in Texas, age 75 years old? Those are the parameters. Could you put an installment, a cash refund on that? How much more for $40,000 would he need to put in? Is that possible? For all the people who are screaming at the podcast right now, if he died tomorrow, he loses the $500,000. The charity is only going to get now $1.5 million, not two, if he never bought the SPIA.
$575,
folks. What does that mean in English? For those who are screaming, the SPIA, if he dies tomorrow, there's nothing. Well, also what he has to do is put $575,000 in out of his $2 million, leaving him $1,025,000. Did I get that right, Chris?
$1,425,000.
Ah, see, I was testing you. Very good. Jacob, you didn't pick up on that. Take your style.
Well, you asked me in his defense.
Oh, all right. Very good, Chris. I knew the answer. It made it sound like I didn't. But I really did. Okay, thank you, Chris, for bailing me out on that. Where I'm going with this, for all you naysayers on that, if he put $575,000 in, that's a cash refund. What does that mean? If he died before getting all $575,000 back, he can name on the annuity a beneficiary. If this was me, maybe I'm naming the donor advised fund that Jim Sonia and Associates will have. Maybe I'll have a wife then, and I'll name her. But if I died before getting my $575,000 back, the remaining money, that's why they call it cash refund, the remaining money that hasn't been paid to me will be paid out. So now everything is locked, allowing $1.425 million to be invested aggressively for growth. Maybe putting a couple of hundred thousand of that in a 100% buffered ETF that can pretty much be sold at any time, even in the middle of a down market, which Jacob's going to talk about next week, and pretty much have it sold at NAV, but have a cap rate much higher than you're going to get in safe cash to help cover unexpected inflationary pressures in the future while allowing the vast majority of that $1.425 million to be invested for growth. Just food for thought. Chris, wrap this up, which gets away from this listener's question, I concede. But a lot of times when we're asked this, it's not by people who have enough money to withdraw only 2%. It's by people who have some rental properties that as long as those rental properties are in, they don't need an annuity. Right. How do you approach that?
Well, it's situation specific, I would say. So remember what you're trying to do. You're trying to take rental income, which maybe you've had the rental for a long time and you feel that it's very predictable and you're allowed to increase rent. You've done that in the past. So it's an increasing revenue stream for you. And you're thinking, well, here's my income and I plan to keep that through retirement so it can be part of my secure income group. What you have to consider, of course, is the risk of that drying up or reducing. And that's going to depend on the rental market where you're at and how stable it remains. So I'd say the physical location, keeping in mind that just because now it's a hot rental market in your location may not be that way in 10, 20, 30 years. So there's always that risk. But what will kind of mitigate some of that risk or concern is if the property itself is not leveraged, meaning if you needed to sell it, you could, and maybe then acquire some more traditional secure income like an annuity. You have to be a little careful there too. I would say you'd want to have a nice buffer of value in there because if the rental market dried up, I would argue that the property is likely declining in value as well. So while you could sell it, maybe not for as much as you thought otherwise. So making sure that there's a lot of value there. So if it did decline noticeably, if you had to sell it, there'd still be enough there to generate secure income in a more traditional manner, say with annuities. The good news is as you age, acquiring secure income becomes less and less expensive because your remaining years to mortality are declining each year, which is a key variable in the pricing of annuities, income annuities. So rental income, I think, is fine. If you're highly leveraged, let's say you owe 70, 80%, the loan to value is very high. So you've got a nice hot rental market. So even servicing the mortgage, your net rental income stream is nice and strong. I'd be hesitant on that because, like I said, if that rental starts to decline due to the leverage effect, you're going to have the net revenue to you decline quite rapidly, potentially. And if the rental income started to dry up, you started to want out into a more traditional secure income source, you just don't have a lot of equity sitting there in order to extract because the house, the real estate is leveraged via a mortgage. So what we like to see is rental income that has a good history. It's in a location where people like to live and will continue, an attractive place that is bringing people in rather than people leaving. That you are unleveraged or very lightly leveraged, if at all, so that all of the equity of the home could be extracted in a sale if need be. In those cases, I think rental income could be treated as a quasi-secure income source without much concern. But it does take a lot more work. I always argue that signing up to, even if you've enjoyed being a landlord in your 30s and 40s and 50s, that's not necessarily going to be the case, the headache of being that landlord into your retirement. So I generally also recommend for people not already doing so to factor in the cost of professional management, maintenance and everything so that you could, when you're assessing the value of that rental income, it's net of all those expenses so that you're not expected to be dealing with the day-to-day headaches of being a landlord when you're 80 years old or beyond. So if you don't already have that, I would probably make an adjustment immediately for predicted net revenue from the rental to include full professional management of that rental if your intention was to keep it indefinitely for secure income purposes. So that's, I think, generally how we think as a firm. That's certainly how I think about it, and I'm certainly open to Jim or Jacob pointing anything out that they might disagree with there, but that's my take on it.
No, I'm fine. Jacob, what do you got?
Yeah, no, I think it's, I mean, it's a little bit more nuanced, right? Where you kind of have to iron out some of the details, and maybe there's a little bit more of the, you know, projections or assumptions that need to be built into it. But no, that definitely covers it all, Chris.
Okay. Great. Well, that brings us to a natural end, probably. And we'll get into the rest of what I teased at the top end of this show. We will reserve for the beginning of the next show. So we will get into it. You'll just have to wait an extra week.
Correct. We should have known that yours truly can take a simple question and go down a couple of good rabbit holes. But I think we covered a lot of good topics. Jacob, thank you. I know you didn't get to share too much because you were brought on specifically to talk about buffered products. But we will begin next week's show. So now you know what next week will be. And it'll most likely be a two-part EDU. Although now that we have the whole show, Jacob, we might be able to wrap it up with just one EDU. We'll see.
Right. Yeah, looking forward to it.
Perfect. Okay. Well, thanks for everybody listening. And we'll be back next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.